Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being here this bright and early Monday morning. We have a number of bills up for public hearing and possible work sessions. We're going to start at the top of the list at this point. We may be jumping around depending on members and other individuals coming in. So we'll start with Senate Bill 59A. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 59A comes to you from your Senate Committee on Human Services. Senate Bill 59A authorizes the long-term care ombudsman to appear in existing protective proceedings that involve residents of a long-term care facility, a residential facility, or an adult foster home. The bill describes the orders the ombudsman may petition the court to enter and limits the information the ombudsman may disclose to the court. The bill also makes personal information in the court files, including visitor reports, confidential in the absence of a judicial determination of good cause. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is an A2 amendment before you today. The A2 amendment appears to be technical repetitions that reiterate the authority of the ombudsman to ask the court to modify a protective order. We do not have the paperwork, Mr. Chair.
We do not?
Correct.
Okay. Fred, good morning.
Good morning. So, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele, the state long-term care ombudsman, and as the long-term care ombudsman, the advocate for residents of long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living residential care, and adult foster homes. The bill before you, the original intent, this is an agency bill from our agency. The original intent, and still even with the dash two, the intent there is to be able to communicate directly with the courts when we have a concern over a guardian or conservator of a resident of a care facility. The original approach in Senate Bill 59, and then as modified even in Senate Bill 59A engrossed, was to actually use the process of petitioning for a protective order. With the main goal and the main goal of this bill to be able to communicate with probate courts and keep our information confidential. The information that we have about a resident is confidential. When it goes into a court, it becomes non-confidential. It just becomes public record, and we wanted to be able to maintain the confidentiality of that. Again, original purpose of the bill, or the original approach in the bill, was to use protective order process. It's a little more complicated, a little bit more arguably intrusive for the individual, the protected person. What we were trying to achieve with the dash two, and I just saw it myself, I guess it was posted this morning. What we're trying to accomplish with the dash two is a simpler approach through a motion to the court rather than actually filing a protective order, with the point of getting directly to the maintaining confidentiality of the records. It looks like in the dash two it maintained both the protective order and some motion language, so it looks like we're going to have to go back and tweak that. But again, the main purpose is that when we have a concern of a guardian or conservator, and a little bit more elaboration on that, if they're violating the rights of a resident through that guardianship or conservatorship, we want to be able to communicate directly with the courts. Currently, we feel that there is a barrier to be able to communicate with the courts, so we have to wait until somebody else files a motion, and then we can object, or somebody else files a protective order, and then we can object from our office. Trying to keep this short. I know your agenda is lengthy today, but if there are any questions that I can answer.
All right, questions. Senator Lithcomb first.
In your language, you said when they are violating, quote, and at this point, since it hasn't been to a court yet or a judge, isn't it an alleged violation? Isn't this a violation in your opinion?
Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, great question, and thank you. Yes. So somebody that's under guardianship or conservatorship is under the court order, and it is a court order that's been, established sometime in the past, and a guardianship is under the purview of the court, of the probate court. And so when it becomes a violation of our rights, that is what we do in our ombudsman's office. I should have explained that a little bit more, but our focus is on resident rights of an individual in a care facility. So for example, and we had a case this just in the last year, this was even after we had introduced the request for this bill, but a case where we have a resident in a developmental disability residential facility, but it wasn't the facility that was a concern, and it wasn't abuse or neglect that was a concern. If it was abuse or neglect, we would send that to Adult Protective Services. What we had was a mother that was still acting as a mother, as a parent of the individual, rather than as a guardian. As a guardian, you should be trying to make decisions based on that, how that individual would make decisions. What we had was a scenario where they were taking the door off of their room so they couldn't have privacy, taking their cell phone away, blocking the phone number to our office, as an example, to keep that individual from acting as an independent individual, so that they could live normally the way they would normally. So our focus in our office is to be able to advocate for that individual's independence, since they are an adult, in that case. So this is a case where we would want to be able to go to the court and say, hey, court, can you, you know, file a motion and say, we'd like you to take a look at this guardianship scenario, maybe appoint a court visitor to go out and research this situation. Instead, what we had to do was wait about 7 to 8 months for somebody else to file a motion. And what that motion was for was to keep the ombudsman's office from communicating with that resident. By doing so, we were able to object. A court visitor was appointed, and that case has now been evaluated. But it took 7 or 8 months to get there because we couldn't directly communicate with the court at the time.
Senator Lethicon.
As a follow-up, describe that 7 or 8 months and who was the active party?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, the active party, as far as who petitioned the court, it was the guardian that petitioned the court after the end of those 7 or 8 months. But in the meantime, again, those 7 or 8 months, the privacy rights of that individual, though living in a group home setting with other residents that were being cared for, receiving assistance with their activities of daily living, in a residential facility, door removed, certain clothes removed that they would have otherwise wanted to wear. There were complications with the employment for the individual that she had wanted to have a job, got her own job, but the guardian slash parent was not wanting her to be out in the community, was trying to shelter her, and we were trying to help facilitate some more independence. For the facility part, they would, they go through proper care planning to be able to ensure the safety as well as the independence of that individual. We were trying to help promote and support that, both safety and independence.
Just one last question. Statistically, how many times do you encounter these circumstances?
Yeah, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum. In our the long-term care ombudsman for individuals that are primarily seniors or physically disabled, so nursing facilities, residential care, assisted living facilities, probably one or two times a year. In a newer program that we have, our residential facilities ombudsman program, which is ombudsman for individuals with developmental disabilities or mental health diagnoses in residential facilities, and this is a program that's been up and running for just about a year now. In those settings, we're anticipating anywhere from 5 to 10 a year. It won't be extensive. It's just for those occasional instances where we want to be able to petition the court to get them to come in and intervene. Courts, otherwise, especially in more rural counties, there's not a lot of judges in those counties, and so probate work is secondary to what they do. So they're not maybe watching the close watchful eye on a situation outside of annual reports that are filed, so that we can serve as some level of eyes for the courts in these instances.
Thank you.
All right, and Fred, can you? I'm looking for the term protective information. That's what it looks like you want out. I see it there now. All right. The reason I bring that up is because when you make the statement that once you go into court, it becomes public record, which of course it does.
Mm-hmm.
And is this, this may be more for counsel as to this type of information for a person who's not under a guardianship, if whether or not that would be protected or confidential?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a fantastic question. Two things in response. Number one, there's existing law that this is modeled on, applicable to DHS. Mm-hmm. Number two, there's a provision in here that says the court can disclose this information for good cause. So even if we assume constitutionally required to be disclosed this information, even if we assume that, that would constitute good cause for the court to release it. So worst case scenario, you have to ask for this information, but it's going to go in presumptively confidential in the same way that this existing statute protects DHS material.
Okay. Thank you for putting that on the record. Any other questions? Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 59A? not see anyone coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I know we have a dash two, but it sounds like we don't have the paperwork, so we'll wait for it to catch up and make sure there's nothing else. Yeah, and what we're going to do is I'm going to be carrying these over, and I guess I'm going to ask Josh on 59A. We're carrying it over. Should we carry it over till tomorrow? Or do you have a date certain?
Let's go with Wednesday. Give us time to work on the amendment.
All right. So we're going to set 59A over until this coming Wednesday. Today's the 10th, so that would be April 12th, Wednesday the 12th. With that, we'll go ahead and again close the public hearing. We'll open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 95A. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95A comes to you from your Senate Committee on Human Services. The bill requires certain securities dealers to notify the Department of Consumer and Business Services of suspected financial exploitation of elderly persons and persons with a disability. DCBS is then required to notify the Department of Human Services, investigate possible securities violations, and notify law enforcement of potential crimes. The bill also permits security dealers to delay disbursement from certain financial accounts when financial exploitation is suspected. The bill punishes violation of the as a Class A violation and provides immunity for good faith acts or omissions. And there is a dash A2 amendment before you today. It modifies the definition of financial exploitation to exclude financial transactions that are made for the purpose of qualifying an individual for state or federal assistance programs like Medicaid. With the dash A2 amendments, Senate Bill 95A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. So, Rick, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, committee members. I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm the policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. This bill addresses how securities professionals can help detect and deter instances of suspected elder financial abuse. The basic problem is 16% of Oregon's population is 65 or older. Nationally, you know, folks hold around $3.5 trillion in assets for their retirement. But also, one in five senior citizens nationally have been the victim of fraud, which we think is actually an underreported number. So for every case reported, that there may be 44 that aren't reported. And so, I think state securities regulators, of which we are one, are trying to find a solution to how to bring up the numbers of how to better detect and deter these instances where we don't know the entire scope of the issue. Financial advisors are in a unique position to spot these signs of financial exploitation. They have long-term relationships with their clients. They're managing their money and giving advice as to what kind of investments to enter into, and so they can see normal life patterns and then be more apt to spot, I guess, unnormal life patterns among clients that are for whom they are managing their money. So in 2015, the North American Securities Administrators Association, of which we're also a member, developed, after a public process of notice and comment, a model law addressing how broker-dealers and investment advisors may play a role in detecting and deterring this type of abuse. Oregon is actually one of 14 states right now that's moving a bill in a legislature and into state statute. We convened a work group in 2016 to work through the issues associated with adopting this model law into Oregon law. I won't necessarily say that we achieved consensus on one point, which is the mandatory reporting of financial abuse to us, but what we did do through the work group and then reconvening after a hearing in Senate Human Services was to try to figure out what's the best way for us to streamline and make the reporting as easy as possible on our regulated entities while preserving that mandatory reporting requirement. So the key components of the model law are mandatory reporting of suspected financial abuse, prompt reporting to state regulators. Typically in the model, it's actually both the securities regulator and the human services equivalent in the state, making sure that we put the brakes on disbursements until investigations can be completed at the firm level and or at our level. And then just making sure that there's immunity for good faith reports to regulators and slowing down those disbursements, because we want folks to make sure that if they're acting under the terms of the law, that they have some kind of immunity for issues that might result from that. So I will turn it over to Aaron Tieberbaugh, Senior Policy Analyst, to talk through what the A engrossed bill does. It's had some significant changes since it came out of, since introduction and in Human Services.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Erin Tieverbaugh. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation inside the Department of Consumer and Business Services. After the public hearing at Human Services, we reconvened our original work group to try and go over and see if we couldn't address most of the issues that had come out of the, or concerns that had come out of the hearing. The one concern that Mr. Blackwell had mentioned that we couldn't reach consensus on was the mandatory reporting. Otherwise, we had heard that dual reporting was burdensome, and so what we have done is we've streamlined the dual reporting, so the reporting just goes to DCBS, and then our role is to immediately forward that to DHS. We have an existing complaint form that we believe can be programmed so that when we get a report, it'll automatically send the dual report electronically to both our agency and to DHS. We've committed to work with DHS to make sure that our processes are smooth here, because it's important that the reports go to us so that we can do any investigation we have, but it's also very important that it goes to DHS, who has the authority to investigate these issues. We work to clarify qualified individuals, who are the folks that are required to report, and also that most of the immunities flow to. We didn't want it to interfere with firms' existing compliance mechanisms. There are a lot of firms out there who already have processes for dealing with financial exploitation, and so what we've done is we've expanded qualified individuals so that it includes persons that are identified into written supervisory procedures, so that we're not actually stepping on top of or trying to undo existing processes for the firms. We clarified that the firms can also contact additional persons others than those that are focused on in the bill. The bill says that if you have somebody who is a pre-designated trusted third party, you can contact them. We also went through, and if there's anybody else that you are allowed to contact through law or contract, you can also contact them, unless that person is suspected of the abuse. That particular part is very important, because about 46% of the abuse occurs by family members or trusted individuals. So if the person that would be your trusted contact is the person that you suspect of the abuse, then you can't contact that person. We worked out to make sure that the timelines for investigation and reporting are reliable and consistent, reasonable with the internal processes of the firms. The AM engrossed integrates the provisions into the securities law so we can maintain the consistency with the definitions of broker-dealers, investment advisors, salespersons, et cetera. We didn't use the penalty provisions in the security law because I think the smallest one is $15,000 and a year's imprisonment. What we've done is we've made it consistent with all other mandatory reporters, which is the Class A. From the work group, one of the things that we've been led to believe is that there are very few sanctions that happen for failing to report. It has to be really very egregious. Because we believe that mandatory reporting is a core component of the bill, we really strongly have maintained that position. The reports of the instances of financial abuse, it's underreported, and we wanted the mandatory reporting also to act as a level playing field for those people who want to do the right thing but are afraid that maybe if they do it and other firms don't, then they'll lose clients. We want this to be the right thing. It's the right thing to report suspected cases of financial abuse, and so making sure that everybody's on the same playing field with regard to that, we feel, is very important.
And then so briefly, the Dash A2 before you was actually started as a way to make sure that their Medicaid transfers that were otherwise lawful weren't caught up by the bill. Legislative Council also noticed an issue with the definition of financial exploitation, which was corrected by this amendment. So,
all right, thank you. Questions, Senator Manning, and then Senator Lethicum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, how many, I guess because this bill is being brought forward, is this a fix or to address something that is widespread? And the other part of that, I noticed that at one point it says report immediately. So could you tell me a little bit about this? You know, why is this bill? Is it something that's widespread? And then, you know, what do you mean by report immediately?
Well, Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, I think for the second part, immediate is not, well, we have a definition of immediate, if you want to. Cover that one?
There's actually a little bit of case law that goes into what immediate means, and it's as reasonable as practically possible. So what we've found in instances in the research and the reports on this is that generally when you have an instance where somebody comes into you and you feel that there's some sort of exploitation going on, there's certain signs of it. They're acting unusually. They're handing over all of their affairs to somebody else. Then the immediate would be, you know, as soon as you can, really. It's important that you bring that report forward. Typically, financial exploitation doesn't happen alone. It happens with other types of physical or verbal abuse. And so immediately is as quick as reasonably possible. It doesn't mean that you have to drop everything and do it right then, but it's important, and generally the people who are required to report it within the day or another day. Where immediately doesn't mean is where you wait for 2 or 3 months, where you wait a week, where it's not practical for you to do it immediately, but you do it as soon as you can. That's immediate under the case law anyway.
Not sure that helps. I think we got the gist of what that is.
Okay.
Thank you. Follow up.
Yeah, it was whether or not this that prompted this bill, whether or not this is something that's widespread, or
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, a lot of the cases that we see in that deal with issues of securities fraud do typically have folks that are of a certain age, and so we're seeing this, and also other states are also looking at their enforcement cases, seeing that this is on the rise. Given, again, the amount of folks that are of age and holding these assets, the states through this organization that we all belong to started the process of moving this into state laws across the country.
A certain age, what is that?
Well, we don't, Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, we don't track the actual ages, but 60 and older seems to be pretty pervasive within the enforcement cases that we've seen.
Senator Lethicon.
It sounds as you're describing this like you don't have a lot of statistics. Do you have numbers for us? Do you have any percentage, total volume? Do you have what kind of reporting statistics do you carry?
Chair Przanski, Senator Lethicon, while we don't have statistics in our organization, DCBS, the 2013 data book from DHS does say that financial exploitation is about 42% of their abuse investigations.
42% of their abuse, but we don't know how many that is of the population at large.
Chair Przanski and Senator Lethicon, I can follow up and make sure I get those numbers from the fact book for you, of course.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. We have Roger Beyer who wants to give testimony on 95A. While Roger's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to testify on 95A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing NAFA. You should have my testimony on OLIS.
And for the record, why don't you just know who NAFA is for those who are out in radio land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The NAFA is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and this is the Oregon chapter.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, while we agree with the goal of Senate Bill 95, we have some concerns with the bill as it is still drafted. We worked with the department, served on the work group in 2016, and didn't make some of the meetings they called between the after the public hearing and the Senate Health Care Committee, but we still have some concerns. One concern Senator Manning raised already is with the term immediately, and I know the department said immediately in this case doesn't mean immediately, but our question is, if you don't meet immediately, why would you put immediately in the bill? The response in the current bill, the original bill, the word was promptly. And my association asked for a definition. What do you mean by promptly? How will that be defined? Why don't you give us a definition of the bill? Because many of our members don't necessarily look to case law or to administrative rules when they're trying to find out what they're supposed to do. Why not put it in the statute? So in response to that question line on about promptly, they replaced it with immediately. And we think immediately is pretty well defined. Immediately means at once, instantly, or without any intervening time or space. That's the definition of immediately. Yet you just heard the department to say, in this case, immediately doesn't mean immediately. Maybe it means a day or two. Well, if that's what you mean, why don't you put it in the bill so our members know what it means, know what's required of them without having to go to case law to try to find out what's required of them. If they mean within 24 hours, put that in the bill. If they mean on the same day or on the same week, give our members a definition, Mr. Chair. That's what we're asking for in that case. Section 3 of the bill we have concerns with in that this bill treats people who do the same job for different companies, maybe even competitors, maybe even with the same clients, it treats them differently in that if they work for a financial institution, they will not be required to report, but if they work for a non-financial institution but meet the same definition of a qualified individual, they will have to report. We don't believe that is just, quite frankly. Why would you take people who work for a bank or a credit union or a trust company, which are the definitions of a financial institution, and not require them to report financial exploitation, yet take people who work for life insurance companies or securities companies and make them report the same transactions? Potentially, it could be. If a person, if the elderly person has diversified their investments and have some with a bank and some with a life insurance company, and they are being financially exploited, why would you require one of those two advisors to report that and not the other one? That makes no sense to us, Mr. Chair. And then finally, it's the issue of training and notification. Does the department plan on getting the word out to the people who will be affected by this bill? We have asked for them to delay implementation and try to get some education requirements or some training requirements into it. I've been told by the department that they will ask FINRA to do that, or FINRA has volunteered to do that. FINRA is the national regulatory body for these for the securities companies. And FINRA has just in February of this year adopted their own rules on reporting of financial exploitation. So I believe FINRA will be training to those rules, and those rules are significantly different than these rules. So how are the people in Oregon going to get that information if they're being trained to the national standards and the Oregon standards are different? So, Mr. Chair, while we agree with the goal of this bill, we don't want our clients financially exploited. We want to work with regulators to make sure that doesn't happen. We believe this bill has problems still as drafted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? All right. Roger, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 95A. We're going to also be carrying that one over. I think I'll be dealing with counsel. Do we have the paperwork right now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think I want to get a couple of questions answered. So that one we're going to carry over as well to Wednesday, April 12th. And the purpose for carrying it over will be for a work session. And Lisa, regarding 95A, I'm going to go real quick, open a work session on 95A, and just state that we're going to carry that over, as I said, till Wednesday, April 12th, and it's also for work session only. So we'll close the work session on that, and we're going to close the public hearing on 95A, and we're going to go ahead, and that one's carried over, as I said, for work session as well on the 12th. And now we're going to go ahead and open up. Should I go ahead and do Josh's last one? All right, I'm going to go ahead and open up Senate Bill 1041. Josh, I think that's your last one that you have up for today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1041 directs the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to study, track, and account for public monies appropriated for and expended on drug and alcohol treatment. The bill requires a report to the interim judiciary committees no later than September 15th of 2019. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. We have a revenue impact statement, but we do not yet have a hall pass, if you will.
All right. I have a blank sign-up sheet for Senate Bill 1041. Is there anyone in the room who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 1041? Not seeing anyone raising their hand, running up to the front. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1041, and we'll come back to that. I'm going to go ahead and set that for carryover also for February 12th, and the purpose for that will be for work session. And that is now closed, and we will go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which will be Senate Bill 509. And Whitney.
Yes, thank you, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 509 with the -2 amendment allows for the Department of Justice Child Support Program to establish by rule distribution of payments for child, medical, and spousal support. The measure would also allow the program to prioritize payments to principal and minimize interest accruals and balances. There is no fiscal or revenue impact with the -2 amendment.
All right. And on 509, I have two individuals that are signed up. Kate, why don't you come up, and then Vera Poe. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program of the Department of Justice. I submitted written testimony on Senate Bill 509, so I won't go over that. But this is, kind of a technical fix for us to be able to do our business in the Oregon Child Support Program. It provides rulemaking authority. That's what this bill is limited to, rulemaking authority, to allow us to set by rule the priorities of support obligation, and including putting principal before interest, which the Oregon Accounting Manual does have interest before principal generally, but with child support obligations are not consumer debt, and it's more efficient and better for the children and the families if the obligations are to principal before interest. Also, there are some changes that will allow us to automate our payment processing to, in certain circumstances, override debtor's designation within the account. If you want the technical requirements for that, either through the automation or why our different accounting has so many different buckets, we're happy to provide those to you.
All right, thank you. Vera, are you here just for questions or you got testimony?
I'm here for questions, Judge Prezansky.
Okay.
And I would add just that the -2 amendments are some tweaks so we could get this exactly right. So we would ask for adoption of the -2 amendments as well.
All right. Is there questions for Vera or for Kate? Not seeing anyone. Thank you all very much for coming forward. And do we have the paperwork on this?
With the -2.
With the -2s. Okay. So before I close the public hearing, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 509? Not seeing anyone coming up. Close the public hearing. We'll go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 509. And we have a -2, is what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 to Senate Bill 509.
Senator Thatcher moves the -2s into Senate Bill 509. Discussion?
Yes, can you remind me what the -2s do?
The -2 are very similar to the original bill. Chair Prezansky, Vice Chair Thatcher. They're pretty similar to the bill as it is currently. They just, as was, I think, mentioned in the testimony, provide some tweaks to get the language exactly right. So it sets forth the three areas where the Department of Justice Child Support Division can establish by rulemaking, and the first one being requiring distribution of child, medical, or spousal support obligations in a sequence that is consistent with federal law. The second, allowing them to establish by rulemaking to develop criteria for when the division may override the debtor's designation for the order of the child support payment, and I think that gets to getting towards the principal rather than the interest. And then the third, providing payments of the child, medical, or spousal support obligation to principal and interest that is due and owing irrespective of any contrary law. And I think that's trying to address that sometimes there are administrative rules in different jurisdictions that aren't consistent with what the Department of Justice is maybe doing. And so that just allows them, again, to establish by their rulemaking their own internally consistent procedures regardless of other administrative rules.
Okay, and I just one other brief question. I think it's a brief question. So if a party makes an agreement one way, would this override those agreements if the rules were such that, no, this is how it has to be?
I believe it applies for when the Department of Justice is when the payments are going through the Department of Justice. So if the party's child support payments aren't, for whatever reason, going through the Department of Justice, I think then what they have set applies. But this would allow the Department of Justice to establish through rulemaking the payments that go through them to prioritize where the payments go.
All right. Any other questions? And the motion before us is to adopt the dash twos into the bill. Is there any objection? Not seeing any, so ordered. And Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 509 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 509 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have a question about this. I just need to alleviate. I might change my vote on the floor, but I'll be a no for now.
Okay. Senator Milliken?
The only issue that I have is with regard to changing the order of application through department rule versus by the individual parties who are involved. If it were only the interest item, that might make sense, but this sounds rather vague as you look at the text of the bill. So I'll be in, I think I also will be in objection as it stands.
All right. Thinking, meaning you will?
I will.
We're going to go ahead and document it.
Yeah, please document it.
All right. So any other concerns? At this point, it looks like the motion passes 3-2. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 509. And on that one, it's ready to go to the floor. So Chair will carry 509. And we'll close the work session on 509. And we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 510.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 510 addresses looks at the purposes for collecting support from delinquent obligors. The Department of Justice accesses insurance company data for delinquent debtors who are receiving payments for an injury or loss, which can then have those payments garnished. While most major insurance companies voluntarily provide this information, sometimes it is not. Senate Bill 510 expands the definition of account to include pending claims, and the definition of claimant is also broadened to include individuals who, while not the primary policyholder, may still be entitled to receive payments or benefits from injury or loss. There is also a dash one amendment which expands the definition of claimant to include an obligor who is asserting a claim for injury or loss that is covered by an insurance policy. We do not have the fiscal or revenue yet.
All right. And Kate, this is going to be your day, I know. So we'll let you lead off and have Mike here, I guess, as assistant.
Yep, max me up. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, Director of the Oregon Child Support Program of the Department of Justice. The bill you have before you, Senate Bill 510, is a data matching bill for the Oregon Child Support Program. We have a federal match program for the child support program for all child support programs, but some insurance companies do not match with child support programs through that federal match. It's not mandatory except in states where it's been made mandatory. And so a number of other states have currently mandate insurance companies to match for pending insurance claims, and that's resulted in increased collections for families. Oregon would like to, our goal here is to put Oregon in the same position as some of those other state programs. And so we have put this bill forward to either have an individual state matching program with those insurance agencies for the delinquent parents who are paying support that are delinquent, and if they have a pending claim for injury or loss, we could match with that insurance agency, or of course, if that insurance company is matching through the federal match program, then that would be sufficient. I will say that representatives from the insurance industry have recently expressed some concern with some of the definitions in the measure and I have permission to say that John Powell and I have been discussing this with Mike and other representatives so we can get the language exactly right. And so we would anticipate quickly being able to come up with some amendments that would be agreeable to all.
All right. So, and Mike, are you going to give separate testimony or are you just
He's supporting me.
Lifeline. Love
my
it.
Lifeline.
Maybe I...
And one more. Yes, sir.
Mike Ritchie. I'm the general counsel for the Oregon Child Support Program, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I do want to clarify just a couple things in Kate's testimony. The existing law requires financial institutions, which includes insurance companies, to match for account holders. An account is defined in a way that essentially means it's an institution where you have money in the bank. What we're aiming at with this bill is to require insurance companies to tell us if someone who owes overdue child support has a pending insurance claim for which they're going to receive a lump sum at some point. And virtually every insurance company in the United States already does that voluntarily through the federal match program. There are a few notable insurers that do not unless they're required to do so by federal law or by state law. And seven states have done that. We're trying to model an Oregon approach on the models in those other states that are already working. The insurance companies are already doing those things. And as Kate mentioned, I have had some significant discussions with members of the insurance industry on basically narrowing the definition of claimant so we don't overreach and get things we don't want to get, but they provide us with everything that we need in order to collect child support. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add an anecdote here. One of the major insurers that had not been matching with states was Progressive, and they have recently entered into the national matching program, and we started to get some matches from that, but they have reeled back and said that they will only match with states through the federal program, but only with states that have this mandatorily in their statutes. So that's an example of how this particular legislation would benefit us here. Okay. For the child support program.
All right, thank you. Questions? Brief. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many states are following this model?
Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, there are seven state child support programs currently, and offhand, I don't know if I have my notes with me. I know Texas is a very large one, but
Massachusetts, Rhode Island,
Connecticut, seven.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions?
Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Kansas. Yeah. I knew it was in there somewhere. So.
Back in the ball. It's Monday. All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I got John Powell who wants to give make some statements,
oh,
I believe.
He's in the room. Thank you.
And then is there anyone else besides John who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 510?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. And I want to make it clear, Mr. Chair, that today I'm just speaking on behalf of State Farm and not the entire insurance industry. As Kate mentioned, we've been in discussions and they are at work narrowing the scope of the bill in terms of what types of policies would be affected by this. In the life area, where you have a contract with somebody and a beneficiary, for example, those situations are different than a liability claim where you're going to get a lump sum of money. And we want to make sure that people who have these products for certain purposes get paid for that purpose. So that's what we're working on is narrowing it to those types of claims that it would make sense for the state to step in between the insured and their insurer who is indemnifying them. And that's sensitive ground, as I think you can appreciate. So we want to get it right is the bottom line, and we'll keep working with them on it.
All right, that sounds good. Questions for John? All right, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 510. I'm also going to put on the record, we're going to carry this over to Thursday, April 13th. So this coming Thursday, for work session, and hopefully the parties will have everything done and we'll get the paperwork back. But Thursday, the 13th, for work session on 510. With that, we'll close the public hearing, and now we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 512. Whitney?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Current statute uses paternity and husband when referencing one parent of a child born to a birth mother. Senate Bill 512 extends the current presumption of parent to include same-sex spouses of birth mothers. The dash 2 achieves this by removing references to paternity, husband, wife, man, and woman. It replaces those terms with spouse and parentage. It also allows court to address parentage fraud based on non-biological parentage. There is no revenue impact, and hopefully the fiscal impact will come in any minute.
All right. So I have three individuals that are scheduled to give testimony. It was written down that they want to. Robin Pope, Kate, you're back up, and Vera, you're up as well. Why don't you all three come up? Who would like to start?
I would actually defer to DOJ unless they want me to go first.
I guess that would be us. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, good morning. Kate Cooper Richardson, Director of the Oregon Child Support Program at the Department of Justice. I'm actually going to hand over most of this to Vera Poe, who's worked on this much more directly than I have. But I will say that this particular bill is relatively narrow to address an issue that the child support program has had relative to parentage and paternity and definition of a parent. It particularly extends the marital presumption to include spouses of birth mothers regardless of gender, which is overriding some case law dicta, and would make a big difference as we establish paternity and parentage in the Oregon Child Support Program. By way of background, the Oregon Child Support Program establishes probably more paternity than anyone else, in that that's a very important part of our job, is making sure that children have two legal parents, because of course before you can establish a child support order, you must have two legal parents on your birth certificate. And we actually have a federal measure for our child support program on establishing paternity in the state of Oregon. So I'm going to hand it over, if I could, to Vera Poe to pull out a couple of the points out of and our scope of our bill here, and we'll go from there.
All right. Thank you. Vera?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. Senate Bill 512 with the dash 2 amendments is...
Vera, I need you to put your name
on there. I'm sorry. Vera Poe. I'm the Policy Development Manager for the Division of Child Support in the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Sorry. It's attempting to resolve one immediate problem that the Oregon Child Support Program has in performing its mission in establishing support obligations for parents who have a legal duty to pay support. And that is determining who has that legal duty with respect to a child born within an intact marriage. The law is clear and has been for quite some time that a husband is the presumed parent of the child that his wife gives birth to, regardless of whether that husband actually has a genetic connection to that child. It's a law that provides respect for that intact family, and it provides clarity for the Oregon Child Support Program. We know who to go after for child support unless somebody else is identified by the birth mother. Senate Bill 512 would extend this same format to an intact family that is headed by a same-sex couple who also probably or maybe definitely will not have a genetic connection to that family, but is a planned parent. That child is brought into an intact family. This gives clarity to the child support program in terms of identifying that parent as someone with a duty to pay support or someone to whom to give notice when establishing somebody else who's identified as a putative father for that child. And so the amendments they're very long, but it's a gut and stuff. But the substance of the bill is in the first section, and the rest of it are conforming amendments, which we did our best to tailor to ensure that the paternity establishment process, when the only basis for establishing legal parentage is a genetic connection of a biological father, that we left the references to paternity in that process intact, while genericizing parentage in general to parentage when we're talking about the legal parentage and duty to pay support. We have been contacted by some stakeholders who have an interest in this bill and have identified some omissions or technical problems that they would like us to consider, and so we will be working with those stakeholders in hopes of coming up with bill language that is satisfactory to all.
All right, thank you. Robin.
Hi, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice, and for more than 30 years, my practice has focused on the area of family law, but for the last 25 years or so, almost exclusively on family formation law, which would include adoption, paternity, assisted reproductive technology matters. And I was here a few years ago when we worked on the open records law very successfully. I've served on a variety of work groups in the state of Oregon through the Oregon Law Commission, and specifically on our parentage work group of now many years ago, where we actually came up with the current version of our paternity statute, ORS 109070, which is the statute primarily being amended and changed by Senate Bill 512. I appreciate having the opportunity to be here today and would be willing to answer any questions you might have. I didn't check whether I was in favor, opposed, or neutral, because essentially I'm all three on this bill. So it was hard to make a choice between the three. I support what DOJ wants to do here, but I don't support everything that is being done in the Dash 2 amendments. And I have some serious concerns about several specific places, and then I think it would help if I pointed out to the committee that currently in Oregon, we have ways to create paternity of a man, and we have ways to create maternity in a woman. And paternity is through the paternity statute, which is ORS 109070. Adoption would be another way to do that. And then we have a declaratory judgment statute, which about 10 and a half years ago, I don't know if any of you knew Larry Gorin, but he was Oregon's paternity guru. And he helped me come up with a process to create legal parentage using our declaratory judgment statute, which is now used in the state of Oregon for people to declare the legal rights, become legal parents, even though they may not have given birth or they may not be the genetic parent of the child. So that's how a man can become a father legally in Oregon today. And a woman becomes legally the mother by either giving birth to the child, adopting the child, or using the declaratory judgment process. We don't have a maternity statute comparable to our paternity statute. It's actually one of the issues that I think we should look at, but that's a bigger piece of this whole issue. There are times when I think it is important to consider biological differences. And I would hate to see us just by going through and replacing the term paternity, making it parentage, not recognizing that it is important at times for someone to be either declared a father or a mother. And then it is also important, in my opinion, that someone be declared a parent. I attached a sheet. It's in part, you know, to bring a little bit of humor to my testimony, I suppose. But we no longer look at how, you know, there are two people only needed to create a child today. There are actually 16 ways to make a child. And when you look at that chart, you can see that. It's pretty amazing what medical technology has done and what we have, society out there, we're being creative. And we need to develop a system in Oregon, a statutory framework, where we can allow people who intend to become parents or who should have the responsibility of being parents, so establishing parentage or paternity or maternity, so that children can be supported by those parents. I absolutely agree with that goal. There are just problems. I pointed out some of them in my testimony. I didn't get all of them, I'll be honest. I got news of this on Friday, so I spent part of yesterday at my office going through the bill. I compared it to House Bill 3231 from the 2015 session. It is similar, but it is not the same. A number of statutes were not included in this bill that were included last time around. I'll give an example. In this bill, we have an artificial insemination statute in Oregon that has two significant parts. So it's 109-239 and 109-243. This bill changes 243 to make husband be spouse, but in the previous section, 239, it doesn't. So it still talks about wife's husband. Those are things that working together we can try to fix. I have a specific problem with a statute regarding putative fathers. I do a lot of adoption work. I think this state over the years has developed a policy and a statutory scheme to support adoption in Oregon. But when you look at 109-096, we're talking about a putative father, so an alleged father. But if we change paternity to parentage, and then saying parentage hasn't been established, I think we're significantly changing the law in Oregon, and we could potentially be saying that a putative father, if he has done the things that he can do under 096, if he's done those things, he's entitled to reasonable notice under this law. But with this change, just by changing that one word, I think we're saying no. We can just totally disregard this guy, even if he tried to step up to the plate. I'm not a dad's pack person. I do happen to think that parents, birth parents, can have rights that go along with responsibilities. So if someone wants to accept those responsibilities, I think they should get the rights that go along with that acceptance. And I'm concerned what this could do. I think there's an easy way to fix that, but right now, it makes me concerned about some parts of the Dash 2 amendments, and that's why I would say I'm opposed to part of it. In general, I think it would be wonderful if we could have a statutory scheme of parentage that fits what is happening in today's world. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Robin. And just for the record, Robin's testimony is posted on OLIS, so it is part of the record. It brings out some of the other points that you have.
Thank you.
What I expect is that we're going to be carrying this bill over as we have in the last one, 510. This 512 is going to be carried over to Thursday of this week, which is April 13th. Again, it will be for work session. It gives the opportunity for DOJ and Robin to work together and see if you can come up. As you know, we're in our last week, and so it's important that y'all do what you need to do as quick as you can so we can get it to LC and do all the paperwork that we need to do. Questions for anyone on the panel? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask once again, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 512? Not seeing anybody. We're going to, as I stated, officially, or second time notice, is carrying over Senate Bill 512 to this Thursday, April 13th, for the purpose of work session. With that, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 682.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 682 was brought to us by Senator Denbrough. Senate Bill 682 allows obligors who are incarcerated to suspend or modify child support orders. We also have the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 sets forth the procedures for suspension of these child support orders. It also reinstates the prior support obligation at 50% on the 121st day after release from incarceration. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact.
All right. And Senator Denbrough, I think you might want to make some openings.
Just a couple, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is another bill that comes from the Task Force on Reentry. We were privileged to have Commissioner Carlson from Marion County on that task force, and she made us aware of another wrinkle in the problem that we've talked about before of individuals who find themselves upon release with debts and obligations that were not properly taken care of and where we don't currently have the flexibility to deal with. This bill, I think, is an attempt to provide more flexibility to make sure that the issues are addressed properly.
All right. Thank you. Janet, thank you for being here. I'll let you start off unless you want DOJ to.
Oh, no, thank you, Chair Prezanski and members of the committee. And I want to especially thank Senator Dembro for and his staff for helping us move this through the process. As Senator Dembro mentioned, I was on the task force on reentry employment and housing and worked on Senate Bill 682. This has been endorsed by the task force, also by the Association of Oregon Counties. Been working closely with the Department of Justice. The Oregon Department of Corrections was with us in a work group.
Janet. Yes. I do need you to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. That's and I wrote right on top, introduce self. My name is Janet Carlson, and I am Marion County Commissioner. So thank you. And our district attorney's office submitted a letter. It should be in the record for you today. So in Marion County, and we provided a flyer for you, we really have a robust reentry initiative, and we now call it our Justice Reinvestment Initiative. We have reduced recidivism for people coming out of prison extensively. We have four prisons in Marion County. Obviously, we have a lot of people who are affected by incarceration. Roughly 4,000 people on supervision that we handle through our Sheriff's Office Community Corrections Division. So we're always looking for ways to reduce barriers for folks when they're coming back into the community. And this is one of the barriers that we looked at. When we work on reentry, we improve the ability of someone to become a productive member of society. We improve public safety. We have fewer victims. It helps the taxpayer because staying in prison and jail is very expensive, and if someone can move their life forward, it helps them be a better parent, a spouse, a tenant, an employee. So oftentimes people coming out of prison have significant debt, and it sounds like you've had a conversation about that. And child support is many times a big part of that debt. So while certainly we agree that parents should support their children and be accountable and pay child support, the situation when someone is in prison and has no ability to pay and accrues large amounts of child support while in prison often has the reverse effect. They come out, they have this huge debt, it just becomes overwhelming, they can never pay it. So they start taking cash jobs to try to avoid paying the child support. That means that the child's not getting the support, person's not in legitimate employment. They end up oftentimes in those cash jobs joining back up with the same dynamics that got them into prison in the first place, and then nothing's been accomplished. That's not the desired outcome. We had a little bit of confusion when we talked about this at the Association of Counties, so I'll just put this out as a sidebar, that we're not talking about accrued child support debt that might happen while someone was committing crimes prior to going into prison. That amount of accrued support will be there whether or not you are someone that's going to prison or someone that didn't go to prison. That's part of the law. But what we're talking about is when someone actually enters prison and what happens then after they're immediately released. So Conchetta's letter that came from the district attorney's office, and I'll just use her same story. Under the current system, say someone was an accountant and they were paying $300 a month in child support, or supposed to be paying that prior to going into prison. And then when they get into prison and have no ability to pay, what happens? Well, they go into Coffee Creek, everyone goes there initially, and then they go out to other prisons. They get a stack of forms. I've never been through this, but my guess is it's like parent night when you come and you have all of the permission slips and forms you have to fill out and everything. And so then when they're going out to wherever they are, they may or may not, number one, fill out the form, number two, fill it out correctly, number three, even recognize it's an issue. We have stories from people in our district attorney's office that people will email them and say, hey, I'm in prison, I can't pay anymore, that's not sufficient. There actually has to be a modification order that goes through the proper process. So in all of that, not realizing it's important, not filling it out correctly, and then once it gets to the right place, the time lapse that it takes for the process to occur, for it to be reviewed and approved, say that it takes someone 6 months to realize they're supposed to do something and another four for it to go through the process. Well, now at that $300 a month, you have $3,000 of additional debt from someone who really could not pay that. Then after release, and it's not retroactive also, the law does not allow it to be retroactive, so the time ticks, the modification happens when it's approved. So it's at that 10 months, so you can't erase that debt. After release, the current laws say that you have 60 days, And then on that 61st day, it goes right back to the $300. So even if the person was in prison, say 3 years, 5 years, did the modification work, got it down to zero, it pops back up to the $300 on the 61st day. And that is retroactive, interestingly. So if someone comes out and thinks, well, no one's going to catch up with me, and they're usually, I think Department of Corrections says someone coming out of prison makes about 40 to 50% of what their earning power was before they went into prison. So now they're making much less than they were making before and probably aren't an accountant anymore because they have a criminal record, that person is still responsible for that $300 all the way back to that 61st day from the time that they that people catch up with them. So this is a process that we talked about in our reentry team and decided we wanted to go forward and try to figure out how to fix it. And then I was able to hook up with Kate Richardson, and we had this work group. And so the Dash 2 amendments actually replaced the entire bill. Language there fixes the problem that I described. And I'm not going to try to describe the fix. I'm going to turn it over to Kate to do that.
Kate. Good morning. For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, Director of the Oregon Child Support Program at the Department of Justice. And I will say first that this legislation that Commissioner Carlson has brought forth was very serendipitous for us because there had been a recent federal change in child support law that would have required us to address the statute that already exists. Already in state statute, we do have the ability to modify, it's a modified to zero, a child support order if someone goes to prison. And then as Commissioner Carlson said, it would pop back up to the prior level on the 61st day. That modification doesn't happen automatically. That was by request of one of the parties, and I will say that many persons receiving support have requested that modification because they don't want the other party to have debt piling up. It required someone to, one of the parties to make that request. And of course, you know, they may have a stack of papers or just learning that they had the ability to request that modification, and modification takes time. So that was, that still added in some barriers for the parties involved. Recently, the child support program, in anticipation that federal law was moving this way, changed our administrative rules so that if the program learned that the person paying support had been incarcerated, that we could initiate a modification on our own. And a modification means that you will review the assets. So it does not mean that, and the ability to pay, it does not mean that it would be automatically moved to zero if there was still ability to pay from some outside source. This bill leaves that intact. The change that happens here is very important for the federal law and we think for the success of parents paying support for their children is that it will suspend support. It doesn't actually modify it to zero, and we have this model already for persons that paying support who go on TANF, on temporary assistance for needy families. It suspends the support order. And that can happen as soon as we have a data match or we've learned of that and can go back to when that person's gone into become incarcerated. And then it suspends it so there's no accrual happening. And then at the end of the period when the person has been released, it requires a review and modification. And this is some of the a review and modification of the child support order that was already in existence. And the provision here that talks about it popping back to 50% of the level, I guess it's a fail-safe if a review and modification wasn't completed within those 6 months. But it has a more realistic time period, and it moves the child support order back up to the 50% of the previous amount only if a modification has not already occurred by that time. So it doesn't go, the suspension of child support doesn't go on indefinitely. I've had some questions in the past about why. Why do we do this suspension or this modification to zero when someone's incarcerated? And I will tell you that that if you consider the family an intact family, that a person who goes into prison in an intact family also loses support and for their family. And the child support orders are sort of created on the same idea of it's a family, it's a non-intact family, but is those income shares. And so finding what the reasonable amount is and based on ability to pay, which is a federal requirement, it has to be based on ability to pay. This legislation then will ensure that we have a more seamless process in place. It means that we have a greater success or potential for success for parents who have a responsibility to be supporting their children on the outside because we haven't burdened them with too much debt coming out. And it makes it much more likely they will become consistent payers of child support in the future.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much. Oh, wait, Senator Lithicum.
Thank you for explaining this, and it is a little complicated, and yet the idea is simple. Tell me how the 180-day trigger that happens, does that happen at sentencing or does that happen at serving? In terms of, do we wait 6 months until that trigger occurs, or if there's a 5-year sentence, do we start at the beginning in terms of determining whether there's an inability to pay, et cetera?
So my understanding is that it occurs when the person actually enters prison. And so sometimes people are sentenced and then they spend some time in jail and then they transfer over to prison, and it would be upon entry in prison. And we had some discussions in the work group about, is that correct?
No, keep going.
Okay. We had some discussions in the work group about whether or not this would apply to people in jail. And part of the problem with that is that you have to have at least 6 months, right, of child support, simultaneous child support in order to do this. And our average length of stay in jail is about 11 days in Marion County. So while, and we have some folks that are there on 1145 that stay longer. So that would be kind of a secondary look for us. But our primary target here is that we're actually looking at when someone goes into prison. And then when they get out, the trigger happens upon release. So then it would be the 6 months from their release date to when it'd be 6 months plus 1 day, right, when it would pick back up.
And Chair Prozanski and Senator Lithicum, if I may add, this is currently the child support program already does a modification when there is going to be a stay of longer than 6 months. And I've asked Mike Ritchie, our general counsel, to join us here at the table to explain that process that we already have in place.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Senator Lithicum, I'm Mike Rich. I'm with the Oregon Child Support Program. I work as the general counsel. The incarcerated obligor is defined in administrative rule, and that rule basically says that an incarcerated obligor is someone who is expected to be incarcerated for at least 180 days. We use the word expected to be because you can have people sentenced to 6 months who get out on 2 weeks of good time, and we don't want to have to go back and reverse all of the suspensions that we're advocating. So the idea is if you make a good faith determination on the front end that their sentence is going to be at least 6 months, then you suspend. And if they're upon release, they've got a 120-day grace period before a support obligation is reinstated. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. In reading the bill, it's not real clear when this event takes place. Your explanation is a good explanation. Does it need to be clarified here?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Lithicum, I would say no, because it is defined in our administrative rules, and the child support program is very is heavily heavily guided by administrative rule, and so we've taken the detail down to that level, which allows some flexibility as well. Since it's for purposes only of the child support program, it allows some flexibility if some situations change.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming forward, all three of you. And at this point, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 682. We're going to open up a work session on 682, and I believe we need a dash 2 amendment, which actually replaces the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 682.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash 2 amendment into Senate Bill 682. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 682 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll go straight to the floor, yes.
Yeah. Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 682 as amended by the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Denborough, you'll be the carrier on 682. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 682. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 765.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. I'll have you for this one focus on the Dash 1 amendment as it replaces the bill. The Dash 1 amendment does two things. First, within the provisions discussing the requirement to include a medical support clause in child support orders, it eliminates the reference to private health care coverage. So there's still the references to health care coverage, just as eliminating the word private. Second, it eliminates certain Department of Justice obligations on child support orders that are subject to support enforcement services where the obligee has entered into agreements with a collection agency. There is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right. And on Senate Bill 765, Kate, you're back up. And Mike, I think you're coming up as well. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 765?
Flip to that tab. Good morning, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm director of the Oregon Child Support Program at the Oregon Department of Justice. This bill, it's really the Dash 1 amendments. This was a placeholder because we knew that there was a pending regulation that was coming down from the federal administration that governs our program, and we were anticipating that it would become effective during the legislative session, which it indeed did on January 19th of this year. And we anticipated that we might have to make some statutory changes to keep our program in line with the federal regulations. So the three points here is that it's removing a distinction between private and public health care for determining appropriate health care coverage. And just a reminder that all child support programs are also required to make sure there's medical support in addition to the child support. It also eliminates the term private health care coverage from the definitions in Oregon statute. And because all types of health care coverage, both public and private, are addressed by the existing definition of health care coverage in ORS 25321. And it also eliminates provisions that require the Department of Justice to disperse child support payments to private collection agencies. As you may know, this is not as big of a problem in Oregon as it is in some other states, but there are times that private collection agencies will insert themselves between the free services of the the state child support programs and attempt to collect child support, and then when it is dispersed, they will be taking a cut of it. And while we don't have this problem to a very big degree here in Oregon, the federal regulation now prohibits persons from using a private collection agency to collect child support, but it does prevent the programs from dispersing payments to them, and instead then would disperse to the person who is the judgment creditor. Any questions?
All right. Yes. Are there any questions? All right, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 765. Understand that we have a dash one, and I believe we have the paperwork. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one to Senate Bill 65. Oh, excuse me. Senate Bill 765, rather.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 765. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 765 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 765 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Lithgow, will you be the carrier on 765?
Certainly.
All right, Senator Lithgow will be the carrier on 765. We'll close the public hearing and the work session, I should say. And at this point, we're going to go to page two to work session and open up a work session on 516.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. You previously heard Senate Bill 516 with Chana on February 22nd. Senate Bill 516 requires any child or support order to have a due date of the first day of the month. Since that hearing, we got in the dash 2 amendment. This specifies that for enforcement purposes, income withholding will be on the first day of the month, even if the due date is another day. It also allows for monthly average for alternative payment structures and specifies when support payments become delinquent. There is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right, so we need the dash 2s to be adopted into the bill. And Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1041.
No,
516.
Excuse me, I am looking at the wrong number. Withdraw that motion. I move this dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 516. Thank you.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 516. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 516 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 516 as amended by the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Thatcher, will you be the carrier of 516?
Sure.
And that. Wait, time out. Hang on.
All right.
Just wanted you to go over again for everybody when things are getting carried over to.
Oh, we haven't done that yet. I'm just.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Don't worry to panic. It's good to panic before I say we're adjourned. So, we're not going there yet. All right. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 516. Now we're going to regroup just for a moment, and I'm going to go through what I have, and we'll make sure we got this right. All right. So this is what I have from today's agenda as to what's moving forward that did not get work today. Senate Bill 59A, Senate Bill 95A will be carried over to Wednesday, April 12th.
So will 1041.
And so will 1041. I was going to get down in there. I had didn't see that one there. Okay. So we have three that are being carried over to Wednesday on the 12th day of April, all of them for work session only, and that's 59A, 95A, and 1041. And we are also carrying over Senate Bill 510 and Senate Bill 512. They will be carried over to Thursday, April 13th. Again, they are being carried over for work sessions.
Which two were those again?
510 and 512.
Okay.
All right. So let's see. Let me just check out one more thing here. Okay, let me come here. And then what I have for the bills that we work today that are going to the floor, we have the chair carrying Senate Bill 509 to the floor. We got Senator Dembrough carrying 682 to the floor. We have Senator Lithgow carrying 765 to the floor, and we have Senator Thatcher carrying 516. So I will pause for a moment, make sure we got everything right. And yes. Yeah, 1041 again is being carried over until Wednesday, April 12th, and it's for work session only. All right, any other questions, any other comments, any other concerns? If not, I'm going to go ahead. Senator Manning.
Just off record, dealing with another subject, you had mentioned last week about having a holding session on Friday.
Yes. Okay. Let me go over that. We are not going to be having session on Friday. The remaining days through the 18th, which is next Tuesday, have been posted. They were posted by 5 o'clock on Friday. Our schedule at this point is we're meeting today, as we have tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday. We will not be meeting on Friday. We will be meeting on Monday, the 17th, and we'll be meeting on the 18th. And at this point, we were planning on having firearms bills on Thursday, but because of the logistics of making the changes that to accommodate everyone's schedule, they are now being scheduled, or have been scheduled, for Monday the 17th. And so that will be the day that we'll take care of take those up. And in between, and then we have Tuesday the 18th, predominantly for work sessions. There is a possibility that we may have a public hearing or two of the bills that are there. So for the new members, we're at a stage now where we have to take action on each and every bill that we have on our agenda every day. That means that either we pass it out to the floor or we carry it over to either the next day or to a date specific. And that's why we had dates articulated for the 13th as well as the 12th, because we're not carrying anything over from today's agenda to tomorrow's agenda. All right. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn us for today. We will be here tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Thank you. Thank you. We will be here tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Thank